Just outside the modern city of Rome is a place called Monte Testaccio, which means potsherd mountain. And literally, it is a mountain of broken pots and urns. This thing called amphora, they were used back in the days of Rome that the Bible speaks of here, large urns that could hold about 150 pounds of liquid. And so this mountain now sits there, probably about 200,000 square feet, just piled with these broken urns, a sign of Rome's wealth and excess, where these one-way trips would be made with all these various goods that came to the city of Rome and then simply discarded in a pile outside the city of Rome. That's what you would see if you went to Rome today. But another place in the world where you might be less likely to travel is to Chile, to the Atacama Desert. And so in the Atacama Desert, there was a pile of discarded clothing. A pile of discarded clothing so big that a group that was interested in it accessed publicly available satellite imagery and was able to see this pile of clothing using satellite imagery. A pile of clothing which grows by 39,000 tons every year. Discarded clothing, discarding goods, a sign of excess and vast amounts of waste and use. And so we're going to be thinking about those, and I want you to keep those images and pictures in your mind as we consider this passage that we're looking at today from the book of Revelation about the city and the nature of Babylon. So we are coming near the end of a series that we started way back in the spring on the book of Revelation, this last book in the Bible. If you miss some out, if you're curious, you can go back. Our website has all the sermons, the previous sermons recorded, and they're available there to watch or to listen to. I've started going back and adding notes and questions. So if you get our weekly email each Friday, you get an email and it goes back and it points to the sermon so you can watch and listen again. But then I've also put a summary with some points in it as well as some reflection questions in that. So you can get that, but I'm going back and adding that to those previous sermons so you can go back and look and reflect on this. Because I don't have time today to review all 18 weeks worth of sermons to go back and do that. But one of the things that I wanted to point out was that the book of Revelation, the focus that I wanted us to understand in the book of Revelation is that it's about following the Lamb. It's about following, that's the title of the series. It's about following Jesus, of being faithful to Jesus. That John, this man who was in exile on an island, was given a vision by God. And one of the primary purposes of this vision was to give to the churches of that day to encourage them to be faithful. Faithful in two ways. One was to endure in the face of persecution. They were facing persecution from the Roman Empire, from the world around them. The second way they were called to be faithful was to not compromise. That the society, that the culture around them was calling them, was inviting them to change their way, to give allegiance to something other than the Lamb, to change the way they were living. And so there were these pictures, and it's in the early, from the very beginning to the end, about staying pure and following Jesus and doing what he's called to do. And there's this movement from the book from where we are now to this chronological end of the world where God will make all things right. And so there's a cleansing of the world. So last week, and so we've been building this, last week we looked at Babylon. We were introduced to this place called Babylon. We had previously met the unholy Trinity, which is the dragon and these two beasts, these enemies of God, the dragon representing Satan and the beast representing political power as well as false religion and propaganda. And all these things that are encouraging people to move away. And so again, the constant choice of Revelation, are you going to be allegiant and follow the Lamb, or are you going to give your allegiance to the beast or to some other power? Whether that's the political power of the first beast, a false religion, whatever it is, you're giving your way to that. And so we meet Babylon, and Babylon is described as both a woman and a city, and it's this image, a trope, if you will, that's used throughout the Bible to represent opposition to God. It's a tool used by, Babylon represents a tool used by the dragon to seduce God's people away. And so that's this picture of a woman, where people are to give their devotion and love to God instead. The city of Babylon, which represents all these excesses, all these different things we'll look at, are trying to seduce people away to follow the beast. It's a city because it represents where we live, these cultures and these ideals. that we can do. And so the first readers, the first hearers of this thing could say, how can this not be Rome? They saw clearly when they heard Babylon, they thought Rome. This city of power and of excess, this power of the Roman legions and this excess wealth, where it could be said that there were two different ways to explore the world back in those days. You could go around the world and see all these amazing things, or you could just wait in Rome because everything would come there eventually. But it's a mistake to think it's only Rome. And so Scott McKnight, a scholar who studied a lot of Revelation, says it this way. He says, each century has its Babylons. Each country has its Babylons. And each state and city, and yes, church institutions and churches, has the potential to release the power of Babylon. Each century has its Babylons, each country has its Babylons, and each state and city, and yes, church institutions and churches, has the potential to release the power of Babylon. I forgot to mention earlier, if you're here in the chapel, there's an insert that has the scripture, and there's also some of these quotes and some other Bible references. In other words, Babylon is a symbol. It's not any one place, but it's any sociopolitical power that opposes God. So chapter 17, if we were to go back to last week, the main point of chapter 17 is Babylon will be judged and destroyed. That's what we learn in chapter 17. We're introduced to Babylon, and it's going to be destroyed. But here's where it's important to remember, like, who is the book of Revelation written to and why? The book of Revelation is not written to Babylon. It's written to the churches. Why? To help them recognize Babylon. To help them to understand what's going on. This is verse 4. If there's an important verse, a key verse to understand in chapter 18, it's this one. Chapter 18, verse 4. It says, then I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her. Who's the her referred to? Babylon. My people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. Come out. It doesn't mean leave the physical city of Babylon. They're not in Babylon. So the churches that John is writing to, they're not in Rome right now. They're in what we call Turkey. They're not in Rome. So how do they come out of Rome? Just to come out, it's a moral sense of coming out of this ideas of things. So that what? You will not share in her sins and that you will not receive any of her plagues. In other words, leave behind the morality, the ideas, the cultures of Babylon. Because if you stay in there, you're going to suffer the same consequences as Babylon. And last week we saw those consequences of Babylon where it says it'll be brought to ruin, it will be burned with fire. So there's this picture of the destruction of Babylon. So chapter 18, as we're reading, isn't a warning to Babylon. This isn't something we take on the street corners and are proclaiming to the people walking by and telling them about their destruction and their fate. Chapter 18 is written to us here, sitting in the church. But if we're going to come out of Babylon, the main point is we have to know what Babylon looks like. What are the calls of Babylon? How does it give us? And so the picture is, don't live like Babylon. Don't give your affections, your allegiance, your heart to her. So I'm going to give a big picture of chapter 18, and then we're going to go back and look. And in some ways, chapter 18, we've done 17 chapters of the book of Revelation. There's lots of strange symbols and bizarre images. Chapter 18, in some ways, is one of the easier ones to understand. At least it's fairly straightforward what it's talking about. So it begins, and it tells us, chapter 18, verse 1 through 3, there's this proleptic prophecy of destruction. Proleptic simply means it's a prophecy about something in the future, but as if it's already happened. So he's saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. So it's a picture of something. And why? Because of its adultery, because of its idolatry. It's calling to do that. And then there's the call to come out. And then in verses 11, a lot of the verses after that, up through verse 19, is all the mourning by kings and merchants. So you have this big list of people who are all sad because Babylon has been destroyed. Well, why are they sad that Babylon is destroyed? Why are they weeping over Babylon? Because they really liked Babylon? Because they had good friends there? Money. They're weeping because Babylon's gone, so they don't get what they want anymore. Babylon was giving them wealth and power and prestige, And now Babylon's gone. And they're sad because now they don't have a way to make their money. Their riches, their excesses has been taken away. And so it's not, they're not sad Babylon's gone. They're only sad because what they get from Babylon is gone. And then we get this brief at the chapter 18, verse 20, this brief thing like where God's people are called to rejoice because God's justice has been done and Babylon destroyed. And then we didn't read Matt, we didn't read that final thing. I didn't ask Matt to read the final few verses, but it's a repeat of the destruction of Babylon. It's this picture of Babylon now not destroyed with fire, but like a rock thrown into the sea. In other words, in the size of a large millstone. If you were to take a boulder, if you go out to the lake, go out to the middle of the lake and throw a boulder off the lake, off your boat, what's going to happen to it? I mean, quickly, right? Just down to the, I mean, it's not going to stop on the way and think about it. It's not going to, straight to the bottom, right? That's the picture of Babylon. Babylon goes to the bottom. Not to, and so the question is, when you throw that big rock to the bottom, is it going to make its way? Is it going to float back up at any point? It's there. And that's the picture of Babylon saying, when we're talking the final, when the destruction of Babylon comes at the end, it's like throwing a rock in the sea. It's not coming back. It's gone for good, this finality of it. So I want to come back to that. The call of chapter 18 is to come out of Babylon. So how can we discern what Babylon is like today? What are we called to come out of? So John was writing to churches who were called to come out of what was going on in Rome. But if we read this, we'll see there's a lot of the same things that he's describing about Babylon, aka Rome, that could be used to describe the world we live in today. So we're going to look at just two categories. We can look at lots of different things, lots of different things we think about Babylon, but I want to focus on two of them for today, for us to think about. The first is arrogance. So chapter 18, verse 7. It says, give her, Babylon, as much torment and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. That's pretty harsh, isn't it? So how much luxury and glory did Babylon give herself? A lot. And so now the angel, the voice from heaven saying, well, whatever that luxury and wealth that Babylon gave herself, give her back an equal measure of torment and grief. In her heart, she boasts, I sit enthroned as a queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn. Do you hear that arrogance? The pride of saying, I sit enthroned as a queen. There's a sense of arrogance, which makes me think of another ruler of a literal Babylon, a man named Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a ruler of the historical empire of Babylon. We read a lot about him in the book of Daniel. And there's a point in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, where Nebuchadnezzar, the king, says, is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? So here is Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor, looking out over this great empire and saying, is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? So question for you, how many bricks do you think Nebuchadnezzar laid in the new palace? Yeah. Probably didn't go out and fight any battles. Wasn't at the docks unloading for the ships. And so there's this sense of arrogance of like, look at what I have done. Well, if you go back and read Daniel chapter 4, God has consequences for Nebuchadnezzar to teach him humility. And so but what's going on here, this I sit enthroned as queen of Babylon, or I have done all this of Nebuchadnezzar. It's the belief that we have done it for ourselves. Which, for those of us living here in the United States of America, is baked into us from the very beginning. What? The pioneer spirit. The ability to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. That sense of American ingenuity and self-starting, of doing it all ourselves, which in and of themselves, they're not bad ideas. I mean, it's good to be self-motivated and self-starting and to rely on yourself. But sometimes it crosses over. It comes to this sense of arrogance to all of a sudden look and to be sitting in your house, to be sitting at all the things you've done and say, look at all this I have done. Jesus even tells a parable about that. In one of his stories where he tells about a man who has all these barns and he builds his wealth in excess and he says, look at what I have done. And he fails to recognize that all that he has comes from God. And so that's where this arrogance of Babylon is portrayed, this sense of I've done it all myself. I've done it my way. I've done it all on my own. And what happens then in that arrogance is then we begin to think we don't need others. So maybe it happens in our Christian life where we get to a point and we look and say, well, I don't really need other Christians. I can do it all on my own. I mean, I made the decision to follow Jesus. Nobody did that for me. I can study the Bible on my own. I can do all these things. And so I don't need the church. I don't need other Christians. And maybe even get to the point where I don't really need God because I've been self-actualized. I've done all the things that I need to do and I don't need those things. And so here's where this arrogance comes in. It can be in the arrogance of leaders. Leaders at every kind of institution, from businesses to schools to, yes, even in churches, we can encounter arrogance in leaders who think they've done it all. Where there's this thinking that our team, our nation, our church is the best and the greatest. Now, does that mean we can't think we live in a wonderful place? Or even to say that America is the best place to live? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we have to be careful then to when that bleeds over into arrogance, where we begin to look down on others or think we've achieved it all on our own. And we look down on others when we begin to use degrading language, when we look at other countries. And I remember in the military and talking with some friends of mine, and they had been on a deployment in a foreign country, and they came back and the language they used to describe this other country was less than flattering. And it wasn't just a pure physical description of what was going on. It was derogatory language to speak of the way the people lived and how they dressed and how they... And you think that's the kind of things we're talking about. Of the language we use, we may say we have a wonderful country. We may even say we live in what we think is the best country on the earth. That does not give us the right then to be degrading to other countries and to speak down and use derogatory language towards them. To think of them as less than, because that's what goes on, because then we fail to empathize, we fail to show compassion, and we begin to think, I sit enthroned on the greatest country in the world and everything else is dirt. And God has a message for that arrogance that goes on. But I want to spend even more, that's the first one, arrogance. Second one, I want to spend even more time, and that's this sin of opulence and economic exploitation, which just runs throughout chapter 18. So verse 3, for all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. And so there's this sense of get hooked up in the way of the beast, the way of Babylon, and get seduced by it. And then it just kind of continues on in a cycle. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. It's this sense of wealth and independence. Or we can read that whole big long list in verses 11 through 13, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn because no one buys their cargoes. We get gold, silver, precious stones, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth. We have woods, marbles, spices, flour and wheat, then cattle, and then eventually what? Even human beings. Which brings us back to that illustration I began with this morning of Rome and this giant potsherd mountain, a city of excess and luxury where they brought in all these goods and they brought in so much. It was disposable. It's like, oh, we're done with that. And then they just threw the containers away to be used one time. Or the pile of clothing in Chile. This unused mountain of clothing. And so I was reading a little bit about this and statistics vary a little bit. But according to what I found, it says the average American buys 53 new items of clothing per year. And sometimes I think, who does that? I was like, I think I bought like 4 last year. I don't know. So somebody's buying a whole bunch. Which one of you is buying all the 100 that balances me out? That's what. But average American, and so again, these are average studies, 53 new items of clothing a year. The United States throws out 17 million tons of clothing every year. Just throw it out. We're not talking the stuff that goes to the local resale shop. We're talking just thrown away. And then, in fact, 65% of clothing is thrown out in the first 12 months. This fast fashion, this idea, well, I need to have the latest and the best. That shirt I wore 10 years ago, I certainly can't, that shirt I wore 10 weeks ago, I can't wear that. Because people are going to look and say, oh, Pastor, you wore that a couple weeks ago. I did. I wore this one. Go back. You can see the videos. I wore this shirt. I wore it a couple years ago. But the point is, we get these ideas and we think we have to keep up, and there's this excess of luxury. And in the midst of that, we're calling out and we're saying, I want more and more and more. And so these stores are selling and they're creating these things. And it's this fast fashion, this cheap fashion. Well, what do you think is happening when we're buying t-shirts for $3 or $4 or $5? Those have to come from somewhere. There has to be somebody making those somewhere. There has to be somebody picking the cotton or maybe producing the thing so that it can be made to us at this inexpensive prices. So where we get caught up in Babylon is, do we remember then who's at the other end of all this production process? And that process from beginning to end, because it's the process at the beginning when children and women are paid less than a living wage, sometimes living in slavery, to produce these items so that I can change my shirt every week. But then when I discard them, they end up somewhere. Maybe they end up in a mountain pile in Chile. Or maybe all of that packaging from Amazon ends up outside of New Delhi in India in these giant piles of plastic where people are wading through it, because all that plastic has to go somewhere. And we like to think we're recycling. Most of our recycling just gets put on giant ships and sent overseas, turned into vast piles of waste, where there are, again, people at the other end picking through this to maybe find a few good things so that they can have a little bit of food to eat. And so we get caught up in the wealth and the excess of Babylon when we do this. But maybe it's not clothing. That's not all of us. But we have to ask ourselves, how have the excesses of Babylon and consumerism taken your heart? And something I want to say about this, the purpose of these passages in large part is for us to reflect about our own life. I would recommend against using these passages, unless you know it's someone well and are in that place to speak, to use them to speak about somebody else's lifestyle and their way of living. It's easy to do that. That's the amazing thing about the Bible, is it's really easy to see the sins, the excesses, the things that it's speaking out against, and see them in everybody else, but fail to see them in ourselves. So please don't use these passages to go down and rail against everybody else, but to consider your own heart. So maybe it's not clothing for you. But what are the other ways that the excesses of Babylon take in your heart? Where consumerism, where buying and getting, where are you tempted to compromise? And that's the language earlier in chapter 13. It talks about taking the mark of the beast to buy and sell. And so it may have been in ancient days in Rome, it was this idea that you had to be a part of the trade guilds. You had to be part of things, you had to offer up your incense or your worship to Caesar in order to participate in trade. So it was giving up your devotion, your allegiance to Jesus in order to participate in the trade, in the economics. And so the question then for us is, in what ways are we compromising what it looks like to follow Jesus for the sake of our own wealth, for the sake of our own goods? Where are we tempted to take the mark of the beast, to enjoy luxury, to become consumers, to become people who see everything as something to be used, something to be discarded, something to be owned and purchased? Consumerism is one of the biggest challenges in the church today. Think of even the language. And language, the more I learn, the more I realize the language we use, the metaphors we use, shape the way we think. So one of the metaphors or word pictures we use, if someone, a church closes or someone moves to a new area and they go to find a new church to be a part of, what's the most common language they use to describe that process? Shopping. Shopping for a church. Right? Not everybody does, but I hear that often. It's like, oh, we're just, you know, we're out shopping for a new church. I go shopping for groceries because then what? I'm in control and I'm consuming because I'm going to what? Get things for me to consume, for me to use, things that are fit my desires. And so you see how this excess of Babylon, this mentality of Babylon says that the process I use to even discern or decide what part of the body of Christ I'm going to belong to puts me in charge as something that I own. Because when we shop for church, when I shop for something at the store, if I go and I find something and I get it home and maybe the date's expired, or I get it home and it doesn't look quite right, what do I do with it? I return it, right? Or I just discard it. So if then we're shopping for church, and we come to a new church and all of a sudden we realize, oh, there's some people here. They're kind of annoying. Well, that song, that pastor, I don't really know about him, but you know, they don't have that program for me. My elder church had that program. What do? We just discard it and we keep looking on. And even if we've been a part of a church for a while, we develop that consumer mentality. Babylon also affects us when we see, do we see our possessions? Each one of us, we own things. We own clothes. We own cars. We own other items. Do we see those possessions as a trust from God for the sake of others or something purely for ourselves? So what we have to do is we look at all that we own. And again, this isn't a matter of how much. We can own a lot or we can own a little. But the question we ask ourselves is, what is the purpose of what we own and use? You see, as it was describing here, the fall of Babylon, what were the merchants, everything they owned and used, what was for the sake of who? For themselves. For their own wealth, for their own betterment. And so we have to ask ourselves, all the things I own, are they solely for me or is there a way I use them for others? Do we consider, and this is, I brought this up already, do we consider how our purchases and spending impact others? As opposed to the merchants who thought of only themselves. Do we think that luxury comes at no cost? We could take this over from that area to, say, the area of pornography. The rampant use of pornography by people. And oftentimes people look at pornography and they think, what does it harm anyone for me to sit in my own room and watch this stuff on my own? Think about that. What is the harm? Well, the harm is there were people at the other end of that. Many of whom, most of whom, I would say the almost all whom did not choose to be a part of that, but were caught up in things. Now there may be some who are, but the vast majority, so there's this trade. So when there's this huge market for child pornography, there are no six-year-olds out on the streets thinking, well, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life is just start pornographic films. But instead people abduct them, people are used, so there's this thing. And so when someone's sitting casually in their room and watching and saying, what harm is done? They're ignoring what's happening at the other end, and that's Babylon. That's failing to see how what I do affects others. That how we and the things we enjoy is done on the backs of others. The brother of Jesus, James, says it this way. He says, now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth is rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. He says, look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. It's not just John and Revelation. It's a theme throughout scriptures. How do we use what we have? And do we build our luxury? Do we build our wealth? Do we build our enjoyment? Do we build our pleasure? Do we build all these things on the backs of others? Because that's the nature of Babylon. And what's going to happen to Babylon? It's going to be destroyed. It's going to be gone forever. It's going to be gone in fire. It's going to be bottomless. I see all these different images, metaphors, pictures of what happens to Babylon. Or we can think of it this way. The last one is like, do we think of it, the economy as the most important thing? So a presidential race a number of years ago, One of the candidates says, what? It's the economy, stupid, right? And what's that say? In other words, we don't care about anything else going on in the country. And I'm exaggerating just a little bit here. But the bottom line is, we look and we say, how's my 401k doing? How's the NASDAQ doing? How's the S&P doing? How's my retirement? What's the price of gas? What's the price of grocery? As long as those are low and I'm doing well, I don't care about anything else. That's Babylon. That's Babylon at work when we see it all about those things that we say, as long as the market's doing well, everything's okay. And maybe we do that as an individual. Do we assume if we're doing financially well, we must be doing something right? Or the converse of that, if someone we notice is not doing well financially, we must assume something's wrong with them, right? Do we elevate those who have more wealth? So Revelation 18, 23 says, the light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of a bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's most important people. By your magic spell, all the nations, the merchants were the most important people. Imagine a world in which the rich and the merchants are the most important people. Doesn't take long, does it? It's the United States. I mean, we think of it, that's, who do we elevate? The people who have the money. And we do it even in church. How many times in church do we look around and say, well, we need somebody on the board? And this isn't every church, but I've been in full-time ministry for 26 years now, served in 6 different churches, been to numerous conferences, talked with hundreds of pastors over the year, read books about it and stuff. And one of the things that often comes up is selection of leaders. And one of the challenges in many churches face is they look around and they look and they say, who are the successful business people? Who are the people who are doing well? And then we put them on the boards of the church because we think, well, if they did well in business, they must do well for the church. That's Babylon, where the merchants become the most important people. Now, the successful business person may be the right person, but it's not because they're a successful business person. The leaders of our church need to be chosen based on their character. So the question is, do we make the merchants the kings or do we make the prophets the kings? Maybe we just look at our own economy as a nation and say, do you ever consider the nation's economy in moral terms? But what's right or wrong as opposed to what's up and what's down? All right. Coming to the end. So, and this is all recognizing that any city or country is a mix of good and evil. This is not meant to say like, any one place is purely evil. Rome had a lot of goods. I mean, Rome produced some amazing things. Even the most evil empires of the world have produced some incredible things. And so a country, a city, a nation, a church can be a mix of those things. But there's still Babylon. And the call in Revelation to churches and to us now is, get out of Babylon. Get Babylon out of us. Heard one person refer to it this way as, you know, it's okay for the boat to be in the water, but it's not okay for the water to be in the boat. You know, or as Paul says, you know, to be in the world, but not of the world. And by that, he doesn't mean we leave the world, because we can't leave the world. We live in the world. But to say, how is it influencing? How is it affecting us? So this is what I'm going to invite you to do this week is to consider this, is invite God to help you discern the areas of compromise. Where is Babylon affecting me? Where am I seduced by Babylon? Because that's the language that he uses, this language of Babylon. It's seductive. It sounds, I mean, it looks, we see the appeal of all these wonderful things. And the world we live in knows that. The advertisers of the world understand how easy it is to seduce us, how easy it is to encourage us to have the best and the latest and the greatest. And so to consider the areas of compromise, and to ask God to help you do this, because we can't often see it ourselves. Early in the book of Revelation, there was an address to a church in Laodicea. And he talks to that church and he said to them, he says, but you do not realize you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. Okay, my question is, if you were blind and naked, would you know it? I mean, physically, we would know it, right? But his point is about a spirituality to this church is they don't realize their own condition, which is why he writes to them, which is why he gives us this scripture, because oftentimes we don't see it around us, and so God needs to help us see it. So ask God to help you see it. Read the book of Revelation. Read through these passages, and even if you don't understand every little bit, you can see these things and ask God to reveal to you what's going on. To see where are the idols of fear going on in your life? What are the things that make you afraid, and how do you generate and stoke fear, and how does that shape your life? Where do the idols of power come in? Where we quest for power and see power as the way to do it. And the power of Babylon, the power of the beast, the power of the dragon, as opposed to the power of the lamb, which is the power that gives up, which lays down its life instead of taking life. The idols of violence, of greed, and of arrogance. To ask ourselves, where are we giving our ultimate allegiance? Is it to the lamb or is it to the beast? Is it to the lamb or is it to Babylon? So I would invite you to spend some time this week. Have a conversation with God. It can be sitting in your normal place you pray. It can be on a walk. It can be somewhere. But have a conversation with God. Say, God, show me where I need to come out of Babylon. Show me where Babylon is influencing the way I live. Show me where I'm being seduced. Because I don't want to be a part of Babylon. Why? Because if I'm a part of Babylon, I will what? Receive her plagues. I will share in her destruction. So God, help me to see where I'm a part of Babylon and help me come out of it. Because we can only do it with God's help, through the power of his Spirit and through Jesus. Amen.